There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits from today's show from Thursday, January the 16th.
Deal or no deal?
That's the question the world's analysts are asking.
I'd say we have a deal. I'm going to give POTUS45 the benefit of the doubt and say that there's enough in this for it to be significant. This is the deal he signed yesterday with China in Washington, D.C. It is described as phase one of the trade deal. A lot of people talking about what it doesn't include, and we'll get to some of the emissions in a second. But first of all, this is President Trump speaking yesterday in a press conference after the signing ceremony, speaking about why the United States needs a deal in the first place.
We never even had a deal with China. In all fairness, I don't blame China. I blame the people that stood here before me. I don't blame China. I told that to President Xi. I was in Beijing making a speech saying how they're ripping us off. And guess what? He wasn't too happy. I looked at him. I said, he's not happy. And I said, I better change his speech quickly. So I said, I don't blame him. I blame our presidents. And I'm right.
And I'm right, says President Trump. That was the American side. This is the other person who signed that document, not President Xi, who President Trump referred to then. But this is Liu He, the vice premier of China, speaking through an interpreter.
As I said during our phone call on the 20th of December last year, conclusion of the phase one trade agreement between China and the U.S. is good for China, for the U.S., and for the whole world. It also shows that our two countries have the ability to act on the basis of equality and mutual respect and work through dialogue and consultation to properly handle and effectively resolve relevant issues.
Good for the rest of the world. And I guess that's the bit that we're most interested in. We are a major trading hub here in the UAE, like a Rotterdam or a Singapore or elsewhere. So it does impact us indirectly. And of course, Chinese companies have a huge amount of investment here. So we've been getting various perspectives on this. Let's start with the chief economist of Dubai's biggest bank, Emirates NBD, Tim Fox. We asked him, what does the US-China phase one signing mean for the markets in general and for the UAE in particular?
So the deal commits China to doing more to crack down on the theft of American technology and corporate secrets by its own companies and entities, government entities. It's also outlined a $200 billion spending package, which the Chinese will import more U.S. products, manufacturing products, energy services, and agricultural products. And Beijing has also promised to avoid currency manipulation to gain an advantage and include an enforcement system to ensure that some of these promises are kept. So I think there's a lot of relief that the deal has been signed. And I think the main relief for markets in general and particularly parts of the world which are focused on trade are that the tariffs will not be escalated any further, so there'll be no further escalation of the tariff war that's been going on for last year. The existing tariffs, though, will remain in place, but it's not going to get any worse. So I think that's the positive to take out of it, and that would apply and benefit all parts of the world probably, but in particularly those that are heavily involved in trade, and that includes the UAE.
Finally, a Chinese perspective on this. Bizarrely, from a German journalist, but there's method to our madness here. Gerard Alfiel has been based in Dubai for more than a decade now. He spent a decade in Dubai as a senior correspondent for Xinhua, the Chinese news agency. Now he works for an organisation that stages China Trade Week here in the UAE and boosts relations between the UAE and China. In fact, he's just got back from one of his visits to China. We asked him in practical terms what he expects here in the Emirates following on from this.
Well, I can quote Minister of Economy and Trade and Foreign Trade, Sultan Al-Mansouri, who said last year, we stay out, we are neutral, we don't take any sides. Basically, any initiative like this phase one deal, which removes roadblocks towards free trade in the world, is good for the UAE. We have a cluster of 40 plus free zones. We have the biggest mainland free port in the world with Jebel Ali. So anything which eases trade tensions is, of course, positive. In relation to Belt and Road Initiative, the Chinese master plan to bring Asia, Africa, Middle East, Europe together to economically integrate, Itaiilu, as the Chinese say, it's also good news because goods mostly flow through Jebel Ali in relation to connectivity between East and West.
It's the voice of Gerard Alfeel. He is an expert in UAE-China relations.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are looking in detail at our top story there, that phase one deal between the US and China that was inked in Washington overnight. We're looking now at what it means for us here in the UAE. Trevor McFarlane is the founder and chief executive of EMIR, Emerging Markets Intelligence and Research. He's in the studio with us now. Trevor, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here as always.
What do you make of this deal?
I think it's very important, very significant, but I don't think we should overreact really until we see how phase two really goes. I think as phase one has already been released, it's a very good news story for relations between the between China and the US, which obviously have been very filled with acrimony in recent years since President Trump. But even as the story and the details are released, there's already the focus is turning to phase two, where I feel a lot of the real meaningful stuff could potentially happen. So yes, it's a positive thing. We should be happy about it. But let's focus on phase two and see how that actually goes, because that's where the devil will be in the detail.
But if this is the first truce, the first warming up of the relationship, if you like, what does that mean for us here in the UAE?
Look, it's a positive thing. You don't need a great deal of quantitative insight to figure out that the UAE and Dubai particularly has a very strategic location within the world. And we connect the world from trade, transport and tourism. So again, when you're looking at a de-escalation of trade tensions, that should help the global economy. It should help trade more broadly. And that in turn will have impact for us here in Dubai. It should, and I stress should, but theoretically should, but perhaps may not in the medium term. It should potentially have an impact on the oil price as well, which is good for us in this part of the world. So again, it's a positive story, and it's important for the UAE from a trade perspective. And it's also important, Brandy, for the whole Middle East, when you think about it, because the strategic relationship that China is growing within the Middle East. You think about it. China has about $340 billion worth of investments in the Arab Middle East. It has about $40 billion in Iran, $20 billion in Turkey. So very, very important escalation in terms of the strategic relationship that it has with the Middle East. And this is where I would disagree with other people in terms of China's view on the Middle East, because, and more broadly across the world, because when you think about, or when the narrative often when you hear about China is that because it has a very much non-interventionist policy across the world, it favors development peace, right? So that's how it develops, that's how it grows these relationships. And therefore, it does not discriminate against different countries in terms of relations. I feel that's people are missing a larger point there. And that is when you look at the taxonomy of Chinese relations and you look within the Middle East, look at the countries that are at the top of that taxonomy. So comprehensive strategic partnerships, the most important partnerships that China has, that is Saudi, it's the UAE, when we're talking about the GCC, it's Egypt, it's Algeria. So if you're talking about the GCC and which countries will benefit in the longer term of a Chinese presence here, it's clearly the UAE and Saudi.
Let's look at it. I mean, that's macro level then. Let's take it down a little bit. One of the things that you do at EMIR is you sit in some very high level closed door meetings with the CEOs and the chairmen of some of the biggest companies in this region. What have they been saying to you over the last 2 years, their thoughts and their feelings about what has been going on between the US and China, and how much will a deal impact their businesses?
I think this is part of a broader narrative going over the last decade. I think everybody recognizes, and we've done surveys on this with some of these people that you've mentioned. I think everybody recognizes that the UAE has been very strategic in terms of, over the last decade, looking to the West, where it has, of course, traditional and very important allies, but also looking to the East in terms of its future demand market. So you've seen this shift and you've seen this growth of Chinese investment and Chinese influence. That has created opportunities for some, but it's also created competition for others in terms of this influx of Chinese investment. So I think broadly speaking, when you talk to these companies, they recognize that the Chinese flow into the UAE is a good thing, but it depends in what sectors, because often the Chinese can come in and from a tendering process can sometimes tender at 20, 30, 40% less than particularly international, big global multinationals, but also local entities as well. So it becomes increasingly competitive from that perspective. In the broader sense, that's good for the UAE and it's good for the economy.
Trevor McFarlane, founder and chief executive of EMIR, the Emerging Markets Intelligence and Research Think Tank. Thank you very much for our time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Yesterday, we spent 5 hours in the Dubai Press Club, which is no bad thing because it's beautiful. There are two reasons we were there. One, because they had a couple of things to celebrate. The second one was that His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid was there. And if it's good enough for His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, it is certainly good enough for us. He thought it was an important occasion and he was there for the opening, as was His Highness Sheikh Hamdan and others. So we spoke with the guys down there to figure out why it's such a big deal. Why is His Highness Sheikh Mohammed there? He doesn't turn up to the opening of an office block, clearly, as nice as it was. He turns up because it's a significant milestone. And here's the deal and the context. The Dubai Press Club opened 20 years ago in Dubai, and its mission was to be a hub for journalists, both those based locally, Khaleej Times, Al Bayan, Dubai didn't exist then, but the local media and the international guys, the Dow Jones correspondent, the Wall Street Journal correspondent, and so on. And it's kind of worked. We hung out there 15, 20 years ago when we were freelance journalists, and it was great. It was in Deira then, because why wouldn't it be in Deira then in the late 90s, early 2000s?
They had the internet.
They had internet, and they had, it was like a kind of internet cafe slash co-working space.
In the days when you went to an internet cafe if you needed to do something.
It was ahead of its time. I swear it was a trailblazer. I think Adam Neumann of WeWork went there and said, this is a really good idea. I'm going to take this and run with it. Anyway, they've opened a new one. But it's also the hub for the Dubai Media Office, which handles the communications for the entire Dubai government. So
can I just say to anyone listening who knows their smellies, they've got Byredo candles and soap and hand cream in the bathroom and Diptyque toiletries as well. I'm just going to put that out there. I was impressed. I didn't stick any in my handbag.
Producer Shruti did send us a message saying, have you taken some empty bottles? Can you bring some back? But we didn't, because we're good law-abiding citizens. So we sat down with one of the people from Dubai Media Office, which is the umbrella organisation that includes Dubai Press Club, to find out what's going on. Noura Alabar. And we began by asking her about the 20th anniversary of the Dubai Press Club, which they're celebrating with this new hub, and why it matters.
I can feel the energy. I hope you feel the energy too. And the Dubai Press Club has been for the past 20 years and will always be home to host journalists from around the world, people from different media industries. Today, we are no longer only in print, radio, TV. We are looking at digitizing a lot, and therefore we will have different members coming in.
And of course, you're opening these doors in what is a big year for the UAE media. Dubai has been named the capital of Arab media for 2020. What does that title mean for this city?
For the media, and I don't want to sound biased, but this is one of the most crucial and important industries. And having, with different things happening around the region, and Dubai being the safe haven, and Dubai being always a supporter for diversity, tolerance, entrepreneurs, journalists, transparency, I think having this title is very important for us. And We've had this all our lives. We've had the Arab Media Forum. We've had the Dubai Press Club. This is just an endorsement to all the efforts that has been happening here in Dubai.
finally, if we look forward to the next 20 years, how is this institution going to evolve? Not just the press club and this beautiful office that we're in now, but in terms of the media industry in Dubai. I mean, Brandy and I were at the press club 20 years ago. You were interning at Dubai Press Club 20 years ago. What's it going to look like in, I'm trying to do the maths, 2040, Dubai's media scene?
Well, I think I work with a lot of millennials, and I think even journalism will start evolving, and we cannot deny the fact that there is digitization around every industry. What does that mean for the Dubai Press Club? Well, it has Dubai at the beginning of its name, so it means we will evolve. It means we will also cater to different needs.
It's the voice of Noura Alabar from the Dubai Media Office talking to Brandy I down at the Dubai Press Club yesterday.
Right, I've been looking at a health and safety warning.
From whom?
From Yamaha Japan.
Okay, the piano people or the motorbike people?
The piano people.
Fine.
They've had to tweet a health and safety warning. What do you think their health and safety warning is?
Do not lift a Yamaha grand piano up the stairs without a crane.
No, it's do not put yourself in a box.
Am I living in a box?
There's a thing doing the rounds on social media at the moment where people are, and I quote, playing Goan.
Oh, you are having a laugh.
By folding themselves into musical cases. If you've been living in a box for the last couple of weeks, you'll know that there is speculation as to whether or not Carlos Goan escaped Japan in an audio box. It seems that he did. There are reports that one was found in the back of the jet that he left on with air holes drilled in it. So, people are taking photographs of themselves curled up inside harp cases. There's been photographs of someone in a double bass bag. And Yamaha in Japan has had to come out on Twitter. I don't actually read Japanese, so I can't read this myself. But it's been picked up by The Guardian this morning. They've had to come out on Twitter and say, don't stick yourself in a box that is meant for musical instruments and equipment. It could lead to unfortunate accidents. They said, we will not mention the reason, but there have been many tweets about climbing inside large musical instrument cases. A warning after any unfortunate accident would be too late. So we ask everyone not to try it.
This is brilliant. You couldn't make this stuff up, could you?
No. So there you go. Apparently that is the new planking stroke water bucket challenge or whatever. Do not, if you've got a musical case at home, don't climb into it. It is dangerous. That post in Japan has been retweeted more than 54,000 times.
Public service broadcasting on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Etihad has committed to having zero net carbon emissions by 2050 and to halving its current emissions by 2035. We are joined on the line now by Adrian Gain, Director of Industry and International Affairs at the Etihad Aviation Group. Adrian, thanks for joining us. Do you want to talk us through this target? What does zero net emissions look like in practice for an airline?
Well, it's a combination of things, Brandy. There's no one silver bullet. So it's getting all the things that contribute to the CO2 emissions from a flight together. Now, obviously, the engine emissions are the biggest bit. So in practical terms, we'll be looking at things like biofuels, sustainable aviation fuels, which have zero carbon, net carbon emissions. And we'll, in the short term, we'll look at offsets. But in the very long term, obviously, we'll be looking at new technology, which will completely obviate CO2. But that's some way down the track.
Let's kick off looking at those offsets, because carbon offsetting is not without its critics who see it as sort of an exchange deal for carrying on as working as you were already working, but just by buying carbon credits. How are you going to do it the right way?
So the right way to do it is to invest in new projects. So you're quite right, there is a lot of controversy about offsets. But if you're investing in stuff that's already been done, or you're investing in one set of agricultural operations which just simply replaces another, then that's not best practice and it doesn't really count. I agree with you. So we'll be looking at new projects across the world that actually deliver additional CO2 saving benefit to the planet, and that's the important thing. And we're very serious about making sure that we play our bit in the industry to reduce CO2 emissions. It's something that our customers wouldn't expect us to do anything less.
You mentioned biofuels there a moment ago, and I know that Etihad is tied up with Boeing to create a special plane, Dreamliner, the Greenliner, in order to test new initiatives. What can you tell us about what you're doing there?
So we've teamed up with Boeing on the 787 program, which is a great aircraft, and it's probably got about 15% less carbon emissions than its predecessors. So it's a very fuel-efficient aircraft. And we're going to use it as a test bed to try new techniques across the board of the operation of the aircraft. So things like air traffic control, equipment that we put on the aircraft, the engine use before and after operations, a whole range of things. You mentioned biofuels. We like to really call them sustainable aviation fuels. Biofuels have a mixed reputation. So we want to have sustainable biofuels. We have, as you rightly say, a joint venture with Boeing here in Abu Dhabi. We actually produce biofuels from saltwater-tolerant plants in a fish farm, which is a brilliant piece of engineering. And we've also teamed up with Tadweer, which is our waste provider here in Abu Dhabi, and we're going to be looking at getting waste to fuel. So domestic waste will be processed into jet fuel, again, with zero carbon balance, which also obviates methane emissions from landfill. So it's a whole range of options, as I said at the beginning. It isn't just one thing, but it's combination of the operations, the fuel you put in, the routes you take, the equipment you use. And eventually we'll get there. And 2035, as you say, we'll be halfway there. 2050 is relatively long way off. If we can do it quicker, we'll do it quicker.
How much is all of this costing Etihad?
Well, it'll cost, we don't have a figure yet because we've just started, but it will cost us, no doubt about it, because we have to buy offsets. We have to develop sustainable biofuels, and those are expensive. But it'll have to be budgeted into the operation. We don't have an alternative if we're going to survive and do the right thing for the industry. So it's something that the shareholders and the board take very seriously.
When you say it'll be budgeted, does that mean that you will take it out of your profits or that tickets could get more expensive?
No, I think it's something that the airline will have to factor into its budgets and its budgets and profits. And we will actually allow passengers, if they want to offset their flight. In addition, we will be developing a program to allow them to do that. And you've probably seen some companies and airlines around the world do that already. The take-up on them is not that high. Probably only 1% or 2% actually buy offsets for their air journeys worldwide. So it's not taken up. But we'll have to find, we're looking at ways to make it more approachable for customers if they want to do it. But the onus is on us as the service provider to make the effort to do the offset. We're not asking our passengers to do it instead of us, if you see what I mean.
Although that very low take-up number is interesting, because we all talk about good green game. You know, we're all outraged by what we're seeing in Australia at the moment. But it seems, from what you're saying, that very few of us are taking the green option, ticking the box to pay a bit extra to offset when we get the chance.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people generally don't do it. I've done quite a lot of work talking to companies that provide offsets, and that is the established industry figure. Now, there are exceptions there. Certain parts of the world, certain routes, maybe it's a bit higher, but we need to really look at ourselves. It's the same thing at home in the kitchen. You know, are you recycling problem? The tendency to be lazy is a bit easy, and it's something that we all have to take a bit more seriously. And what we've announced yesterday on the CO2 is just an example of that.
How much can Etihad do on its own or with one or two partners like Tadweer and Boeing? And how much does the industry have to do together? I mean, presumably we can't end up with a situation where every single airline around the world is using a slightly different type of fuel.
No, that's a great question, Brady. I think that's the key. This has got to be an industry solution. And we're just trying to make our mark now. But at the end of the day, it's got to be the whole industry has to come together so that we have unified air traffic control routes which aren't zigzagging around the world, so that we have the technology from the manufacturers, so that we have sustainable biofuels available in each airport. So we have to have governments doing their bit to provide the basis to allow those things to happen. So, yeah, you're quite right. It's not one airline can't change this on its own, but collectively we'll get it done.
And is that happening? I mean, are there conversations? Are people working and playing nicely together?
No, very much so. I mean, the industry is coming together. As you probably know, there's a scheme that's run by ICAO, which is the UN arm of aviation, to set targets for 2050, and that's being rolled out at the moment across the world through civil aviation authorities. So that's at the regulatory level. Biofuels, the industry is coming together to try and produce as much as we can in terms of what will work in terms of supply chains. The manufacturers are now coming together and looking at electric aircraft, for instance, new engine technology. So, yes, it is happening. It's getting there, but it's a slow process.
Adrian Gaines, Director of Industry and International Affairs at Etihad Aviation Group. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back Sunday morning live on air, 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.